If you're enjoying this podcast, you'll probably also enjoy the History Extra podcast, where we bring listeners fascinating conversations on history's best stories, from ancient Rome to World War II. Just search for History Extra to follow and subscribe.
Hello, and welcome to the History Extra podcast mini-series, History's Greatest Cities, exploring Europe's most beautiful, intriguing, and historically significant cities. I'm Paul Bloomfield, travel writer and history fan, and in each episode of this series, I'll be virtually roaming the streets and sights of a great metropolis in the company of an expert historian guide. Together, we'll delve into origin myths and uncover stories of shifting populations, conflicts and culture, wealth and weakness. And we'll visit key locations that reveal fascinating insights into the people and events that shape the modern city. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Colin Jones, Emeritus Professor of History at Queen Mary University of London and Visiting Professor at the University of Chicago. Colin has studied and lectured on 18th century France and the history of Paris for many decades. He's the author of Paris, Biography of a City, and his most recent book is The Fall of Robespierre, 24 Hours in Revolutionary Paris, published by Oxford University Press. His deep knowledge of the French capital makes Colin the ideal guide to lead us along the boulevards and riverbanks and around the monuments and museums of this captivating city. Together, we'll explore bastions and burial sites and visit places of worship and entertainment. We'll also meet some of the characters who influenced Paris, Europe, and the wider world over many centuries. Along the way, we'll hopefully shine new light on less known aspects of this fascinating city. So, Colin, welcome. In your biography of Paris, you discuss the impossibility of writing a complete history of the city. Well, today we'll try to run through the key moments and sites in just half an hour or so. Where should we begin? Who were the first people to live in the place we now call Paris?
Paris has a history going back over 2,000 years, and we really know most about it from the moment that Julius Caesar in 52 BCE conquered it. But we do know from archaeological evidence that there were people living in the place that we call Paris now, 4,000 or 5,000 years BCE. Quite recently, in fact, archaeologists dug up down at Bercy, which is just what's within Paris, but it's to the east of Paris, a number of sort of dugout canoes, which show that people were there in that period. I think it's really interesting, actually, incidentally, that they were canoes, because it brings out something that's really, really important in Paris's history, which is the river running through it. And in fact, that is really important for its eminence over the centuries and millennia, in fact. The fact that that river goes way back into France and is navigable right back there, but then goes out the other way towards the Atlantic, means that it's a fantastic channel for trade and people and everything for all that period. The earliest people that were important, in fact, in the Roman and then the medieval city, were in fact the boatmen. The corporation of boatmen, even under the Roman Empire, were probably the most important corporative group. So the sort of merchants are really, really important there. I should say that the other thing which maybe we could just mention initially, because we talked about the river, but the other thing that's really important is that from prehistoric times, before the Romans then, there was clearly a road, north-south road, which crossed that river. And don't forget, it's a very wide river. It is difficult to cross the further you get along it towards the sea. But we know that, well, what we have now are two islands left in the middle of the city, as you know, the Île de la Cité, on which Notre Dame stands, and just behind it, the Île Saint-Louis. Well, before there were quite a few, they weren't so distinct. It was a sort of marshy, boggy sort of area. In fact, the Romans called Paris Lutetia, using a word that was probably Gaulish as well as Latin, in fact, lutum, which means mud. So it's really, really muddy. But that muddiness and the existence of those islands meant that it was crossable there. So it became a crossroads. And I think that north, south, east, west dimensions that it has for transporting men and goods, etc., is really, really important. I should say that we're pretty sure that that road ran down the Rue Saint, if you do this, if you're in Paris, walk down it, the Rue Saint-Denis, and then cross over the river and carry on down south, but down the Rue Saint-Jacques. And that's more or less the prehistoric road that you'll be following. And obviously the river was there in prehistoric times, although it looked different as well.
So who were the people who were living there before the Romans arrived? What do we know about them?
The Romans actually identified probably 60, 70 tribes throughout Gaul when they conquered it. And one of them, which is a sort of small grouping, it seems, were called the Parisii, and they were, you know, in that sort of area. Interestingly, although historians and everyone has always believed that Paris was founded on the Ile de la Cité, that is the sort of place that Julius Caesar remarks on, an island in the Seine when he writes his account of the war against the Gauls. But archaeologists found a few years ago, actually, quite a lot of impressive Roman remains just a mile or so up at Nanterre, which is in the suburbs of Paris and on the Seine. And there was some talk that actually the prehistoric capital of the Parisii might have been Nanterre. But actually, the jury's out, but I personally think that maybe Paris was right. Sousa talks about an island. That probably is the island that he's thinking about. And it's certainly there that the Romans built their city of Lutetia.
So the Romans arrived under Julius Caesar, and that was around 52 BC, is that right?
That's right. It becomes a city in the Roman Empire. We are so used to thinking of Paris as a great, fabulous, world historical city that we have to think again when we look at the early history of this city, because really for the first 400 or 500 years of its existence, it's just a not terribly fabulously great provincial city within greater Gaul. The capital of Gaul is actually Lyon. Nearly all the most impressive cities, the most impressive Roman remains are actually found in the Roman, you know, they're still there, places like Arles and Avignon, etc. So it's got this sort of secondary status, really, as a city. And a lot of the importance which it does have is partly because it's on this sort of hub of a transport hub, but also it's just a bit set back from the Roman frontier with the Germans. And so although that frontier is endlessly policed, you know, there's a sort of fortifications and armies kept along there, this is a sort of reserve back headquarters, if you like, for military purposes. But it's not a great city. When the Romans go, it becomes even less significant. Maybe we think maybe sort of 8,000 or 9,000 people might have been there under the Romans. By the end of the first millennium, we're talking far, far fewer than that. The city really goes into a decline, partly because Gaul goes into a decline, the West goes into a decline following the Roman Empire. It's only really after year 1000, and really more or less after 1100, that Paris has this sudden appearance on the stage, and it sort of takes off like a rocket. Takes off like a rocket in the 12th and 13th century, and is very soon the biggest city in the West. And, you know, it's a world, you know, on world scale as well, it's pretty large. It remains the biggest city in the West right through till the late 17th, 18th century when it's overtaken by London. But as well as size, it's always had this grandeur. It's always been a sort of magnificent city, a city which is, it's a capital city, which flaunts itself, which flaunts power, which flaunts the power of the dynasty, which flaunts everything that's going on in it. What happens really in the other great change, if we're giving a very much a thumbnail sketch there, is in the 19th century, when it is, you know, the most historic, the most full of great monuments of the past, etc., in the West. Baron Haussmann, under the Second Empire of Napoleon III, the prefect of Paris, makes the Paris that we now know. He drives these boulevards through it. He destroys quite a lot of the historic built environment, but he makes Paris the city of modernity, which it really becomes, and then in some ways still is.
Should we jump back a little bit? You mentioned, so obviously the Roman Empire, as we know, declined mostly around the turn of the 5th century. Are there any remnants from that Roman or pre-Roman era that visitors can see in Paris today?
Yes, and what is interesting is that most of what we can see has only been visible quite recently, in fact, because Paris was so built over that many of these Roman remains were lost. Roman Lutetia, Paris under the Romans, was essentially just about contained within, if you think of it, the Latin Quarter, the 5th arrondissement, the left bank there, plus the two islands on the center of the city. And with one exception, which I'll talk about in a minute, nearly everything under there, the road system or the buildings, were lost and only really discovered when Baron Haussmann in the 19th century that I just mentioned was basically redesigning the city and driving these roads, these straight boulevards through the city and uncovering a lot of the Roman remains. Now, one of the things which I perhaps we'll talk about later is it's one of the places I think people should visit if they want to, is the Roman arena, the so-called Arène de Lutèce, which was discovered precisely in the late 19th century. The other place which actually was there, although people didn't really know what it was if you go up the Boulevard Saint-Michel, again on the left bank, you'll come to the Cluny Museum. It's the Museum of the Middle Ages. And part of that, part of it's a medieval monastery, but part of it is what we think is the old Roman baths. And in fact, for many centuries, people thought that this was where Julius Caesar had his palace. In fact, Julius Caesar did not have a palace in Paris, but it was about the only remnant of the Roman Empire in Paris that existed in any visible form until the late 19th century, for 1,500 years of Paris's history.
So, as we say, the Romans effectively left, the city declined. What changed to kickstart the growth of Paris those centuries later, so sort of in the later Middle Ages?
Yes, I mean, I've mentioned, I think, the geographical advantages that Paris really had, which, you know, was a definite asset. And the other asset, which isn't geographical, but it's historical, but initially it's not cashed in, if you like, is that from early in the 6th century, the Franks, a Germanic tribe, which had invaded much of Gaul and in particularly that northeast corner down to Paris and then conquered much of the rest of the Gaul, at least for a little while. Basically, the king of the Franks in the early 6th century, Clovis, elects Paris as his capital. Okay, there are lots of Franks, there are lots of Germanic tribes, there are lots of barbarian tribes floating around what becomes France in that period, and they all elected capitals, but we don't think about those. The point was that the Franks became the core of the dynasty, which then basically became the dynasty which ruled France through the Middle Ages. So although it's a key asset which Paris holds in its hands, that it is a capital city, it's only really cashed in when from the 11th and 12th century, Paris really becomes a power, as I say, shoots up into the air. And that's because the Capetian dynasty really becomes powerful. It knocks out the English, who have established an empire, the Angevin and Plantagenet empire in eastern France. It absorbs the Normans. It builds up northern and then the much of the rest of southern France into the Kingdom of France. Other things are going on there as well. I think that, you know, the capital city of a major king, but also from the 12th century, really from the 12th and 13th century, the city becomes one of the most important intellectual centers of the West. And I think it could claim from the 12th and 13th century to be the intellectual hub, the intellectual center of Western Europe. This is because of the growth of the university. Initially, teachers standing around in the street with groups of young men and students listening to them and taking it all in. How has it all changed, you may ask? But then becoming more institutionalized, the Sorbonne is created, at first the college and then the other colleges. University of Paris, very much like Oxford and Cambridge or other medieval universities where there's sort of colleges are dotted around the site. Most of those were actually destroyed or used for other purposes after the French Revolution, but a very sort of collegiate city. People call it the Latin Quarter, I think really only from the 19th century, because the idea is that on the left bank, you only spoke Latin. You could only hear the students speaking Latin because that was the language of instruction. I think very unlikely to be true. But it does have that sort of southern intellectual center. It becomes the center of book production, even before print, actually. So manuscript illumination are taking place there. It becomes then the publisher's hub once the print comes in the 15th century. Even today, if you walk around the Latin Quarter, you see lots of the big publishing houses have their headquarters there. So that's a sort of vocational thing of that area. The southern Paris, Paris of the left bank, is the Paris, the intellectual hub. And that mixture of intellectual hub, geographical trading hub, and then capital city, political power, political authority, I think is really, really important.
And how did then impact on the physical structure of the city? How did it grow and what did it look like at that time?
Yeah, Paris is, it's in some ways, it's a legible city. Its history is legible in that, you know, it sort of starts out in the middle and then grows outwards, you know, whereas in London, obviously, you've got the city and then you've got the Westminster, it becomes a bit more complicated. But Paris just sort of expands outwards from a, like a sort of expanding dartboard or something. You know, when you look at the medieval city on a map, what strikes you is how small it was. Actually, it was a big medieval city. But we do start getting walls around it from the 12th, sensible walls, which are around it. They take more of the right bank, the sort of business and you know, central government within them than the south bank. But when you look at the map of Paris, and people will know, listeners will know, where the Louvre is. Well, the Louvre was the western wall. That was the western wall of Paris. So it's rather small. It then expands. Obviously, the suburbs grow up around it, and then that they become incorporated in, and the city grows and grows over the centuries.
So you mentioned the Capetian dynasty, so the dynasty founded by Hugh Capet. So what happened to the Capetian dynasty? And, you know, we know of the great emperors, the great kings of later years. What happened after that period, the 14th, 15th century?
The Capetians are a lucky dynasty. For generations, they produce an heir, a male heir, and there's no problem. There's no hassle. You just get on with governing. But in 1328, their luck runs out. There is then a dispute over who should succeed and what the laws of succession were. And it's interesting and relevant, really, because it leads to a pretty grim period in Parisian history and indeed French history more generally, because there is a dispute over the succession, which involves the French on one side, who supports a collateral line of the Capetians, the Valois, becomes the Valois dynasty, but the English, through intermarriage, et cetera, also have their claim on the French throne. And this leads, in fact, less than 10 years after the accession of the first Valois in 1328, to the beginning of what historians have called the Hundred Years' War. The Hundred Years' War is a pretty grim period for Paris and for much of France. It becomes the battlefield, if you like, for these two major powers of Western Europe slugging it out. And indeed, when things go really badly for the French at the end of the 14th and then into the 15th century, actually, as we all know as people with British heritage, Battle of Agincourt in 1415 completely crushes the French military machine and leads to an alliance between England and France in 1420, which actually sets up, interesting really, it never really worked, but essentially a dual monarchy with the son of Henry V due to become the king of England and France. And indeed, Paris is occupied by the English from 1420 to 1435. And Henry VI of England is actually crowned King of France in Notre Dame Cathedral. I should say that is interesting and also a sort of piece for the trivia competitions, because he is the only king ever to be crowned, I believe, in Notre Dame, because just about all of the French kings, their customary ceremonial place of coronation is Reims in the east of France. 1435, the English fall back. By 1450, they're out. But this has been a tough period. There's an economic depression. In 1348, you've had the Black Death, which wipes out maybe a third, maybe up to a half of the population. Cities in very, very tough times. And it only really starts reviving at the end of the 15th and into the 16th century when you get the Renaissance coming through.
And how did that affect Paris, the Renaissance, obviously intellectually and artistically, but also physically and politically?
Yes, there's a lot of building in the Renaissance period, and the city expands. It expands out to the sort of, well, if you think of the area of the inner, what are called the Grand Boulevard, Paris is sort of within that, and it's on the left bank as well. You've got many of the great buildings that we go and see now. The Louvre would be the best example. Also, as you go into the 16th and to the 17th century, you've got many of the other great buildings, the Invalides, indeed, well, Notre Dame's been there before, but and also the changing of the street plan as well. With the expansion comes the creation on the western side of the Champs-Élysées and the Place, what is now the Place de la Concorde, is originally the Place Louis XV in the 18th century. One of the things which always strikes me about Paris, looking around, I wonder whether others do as well, that the colour, the sort of tonality of the built environment is very specific. I mean, it's partly to do with the light, I think, in Paris, which has a certain quality, which actually even the Roman Emperor Julian mentioned in the fourth century. But it's also that the materials of which the built environment is made are actually very distinctive, and they are under Paris. Paris is a city that's built itself, if you like, from its innards. It's gone down. These caves still exist, although people don't let you, you're not allowed in there largely. But that is a big producer of that very creamy and delightfully subtle Parisian stone, limestone, Parisian limestone, Pierre de Paris. But also, particularly in the northern areas, there are big deposits of gypsum, and gypsum produces plaster of Paris, and the plaster of Paris, which again is one of the distinctive elements of which the city is built, is very, very obvious, and helps give Paris this sort of unity of feel, if you like, of color palette, which is very distinctive. Very little brick, incidentally, in Paris until later periods.
So we've talked about the Renaissance and the development of Paris culturally, artistically, and physically. Obviously, after the Renaissance, we have this period of Reformation across Europe, and France wasn't exempt from its problems with religion, was it, at that time?
Yeah, no, to go back to the 16th century, that's right. I've said that Paris starts emerging, the city starts emerging. Actually, another building from that period is the Hôtel de Ville, which, although it burnt down in the 19th century, was recreated in very much the Renaissance style. You get print coming in, which makes enormous difference. Paris becomes the printing capital. But then the Reformation in France really divides the country and divides Paris as well, actually. Protestantism does very well, actually, in France. There are big areas in France, but Paris itself becomes associated with sort of radical Catholic wing, very, very antagonistic to Protestantism. And what you have in the late 16th century, from 1560s onwards, is a series of wars, internal civil wars, essentially, between Protestant factions and Catholic factions, complicated by the fact it's not just religion, it's also overmighty subjects, trying to get their foot in the political door and things like that. So it's very, very tough. And then what makes it worse is the Valois dynasty conks out. We're lacking a male heir from the Valois from 1589. And not only is there then, well, who's going to succeed, but the obvious successor by the succession laws within France at that time would be a guy who is Henry of Navarre, in the southwest of France. He is a Protestant. Now, how on earth you get a Protestant king in a country which is riven by warfare, in which the Catholics are three quarters of the population? It's impossible. And so the only way that Henry IV decides to square the circle is to become a Catholic. He converts from Protestantism to Catholic. So the Protestants stick with him because, he's obviously been a supporter. The Catholics are won over. And it creates the third branch of the royal house, the Bourbon house, which lasts down to the Revolution and indeed a bit beyond. But so Henry IV, although those religious wars and that civil conflict, they do carry on after Henry IV into the early 17th century. You have a sort of remodeling of the monarchy under Louis XIII and particularly Louis XIV, which puts Paris again really at the heart of his plans.
And of course, famously, the Sun King and the developments of the Grand Siècle were one of the great eras of Paris. What difference did that make to the city?
Well, it's really interesting, that again, so much building goes on in that time, and a lot of it is power building. So if you go to the Louvre, you'll see the East Front. Well, that was put there, and much of the rest of it was put there in this period. And initially, Louis XIV wants his capital to be commensurate with what he thinks he is himself, which is the greatest ruler in Western Europe. He wants to make Paris the new Rome, and he instructs his famous minister, Colbert, to make sure this happens. And they put a lot of money into building works within the city. But, and this is a big but actually, Louis XIV was never a great fan of Paris as a city, or I should say he's less keen on Parisians maybe than he is on Paris, because in his childhood, when he's just a kid actually, there is a sort of outbreak of civil disturbance, civil war really, the so-called Fronde. At one moment, his mother has to lead a crowd of Parisians into his bedroom to reassure them that he hasn't fled Paris and is still there. So he has a pretty bad view of Parisians as being a bit of a rumbustious and turbulent crowd. And this doesn't go down well at all with a king who thinks that he's there by divine right and has absolute power, etc., etc. So, of course, from the 1680s, he builds Versailles and is very, very rarely in Paris as well. And I think this is one of the interesting things about Paris in the 18th century is this kingless capital, really, which still remains great, which still has all the sort of flaunting architecture of the dynasty, but which makes itself in some ways more interesting without the king by becoming a big major intellectual center of the Enlightenment, as well as the big consumerist center of one of the big consumer centers of the world, which creates fashion, creates the sort of luxury objects that everyone wants to buy, because Paris fashion, both in clothing and dress, but also in sort of furnishings, becomes the sort of the top end set of brands, if you like, which people want to associate themselves with across the Western world.
And can we still see any evidence of that today, both the intellectual and the commercial side?
Funnily enough, it's the commercial side you can see. One of the places I'm going to suggest people might want to go is the Rue Saint-Honoré, which is the fashion center. It's where the essentially design houses really start up. One of the things they used to do every year, there'd be two seasons, as indeed there are now, two fashion seasons. And they'd had these dolls, which were mass produced, and they would dress this doll in either the spring fashion or the autumn fashion. And they'd send them out all over the world, so everyone knew what people were wearing in Paris that year. Now, if you go down the Rue Saint-Honoré, you see there are the remnants of that world. In terms of the intellectual stuff, there, a lot of it goes on in the intellectual goes on in printing houses, many of which have gone, or in private residences, the salon, things like that. You can see some of the academies, which were actually constructed a bit earlier. One of the places you can go to, I think you get a good sense of it, is some of the cafes, because the coffee houses, again, a place of intellectual ferment in the Enlightenment. And some of these still exist. The most famous is the Procope, where Voltaire and just about everyone you ever heard about in the 18th century intellectual world went to have coffee. You could also go into the other side of the river on the right bank to the Palais Royal. The Palais Royal was built in the 17th century, but it really becomes a major commercial hub, almost like a modern mall in the late 18th century. And there are one or two shops there, and in particular, the restaurant, the Véfour, Le Grand Véfour, which has maintained its sort of 18th century style. There's beautifully, beautifully interior design and paintings there. So you see these sort of little bits and pieces around the place. But a lot of the Enlightenment goes on in the head in some ways, and the built environment isn't changed to accommodate those intellectual movements.
So you're painting a vivid picture of a city where people are talking and shopping and drinking and enjoying themselves, if you've got money. But of course, for a big part of the population, that wasn't the case. And that became increasingly clear throughout the 18th century, didn't it?
That's right. I mean, and if you look at the French Revolution, one of the things that happens is that the people take power. It's the people of France, but the people of Paris are in the leading edge of change. The number of the revolutionary days, the 14th of July when the Bastille is stormed, the overthrow of the king on the 10th of August in the Tuileries Palace, near the Louvre. These days of political action are incredibly important, and it builds up the tradition, which does date back, before the revolution, but really builds up to this idea that the French popular classes are the sort of revolutionary yeast, if you like, of radical change in the 19th century. it is one of the features. There are others, and historians dispute even this, but myself, I don't think there's any doubt that in the 19th century, when people start thinking, well, let's modernize Paris, and in particular, Napoleon III's prefect, Baron Haussmann, think they've got to redo the city. One of the things they do is basically take over or take possession of popular Paris, those central, most ancient areas of Paris, which are very often, you know, we don't get that sense now, overbuilt, you know, tenement buildings, terribly crowded, very narrow streets. You get some of that, but it's usually off the boulevard. You don't get that much of it. But that's what really all the center is like. And he says, well, basically, we need air, we need to ventilate, we need fresh air to sort of get rid of all the disease and all the popular radicalism that's around in these places. And he just drives these boulevards through the center. And as he's doing that, what he's doing is I won't say it's gentrifying it because that's far too gentle and moderate a term. He's basically modernizing it in the sort of epic, epochal way and driving out the popular classes from the center of Paris. So you've got this movement out. To some extent, the suburbs are always where the poorer people live, but it becomes much stronger, if you like. So basically, Haussmann and Napoleon III and then the Third Republic after as well, reoccupy central Paris and make it fit for the bourgeoisie to live in. And basically, you know, okay, you've got some workers there as well. They have to come and work somewhere, but they're pushed outwards. And you've got this sort of pushing outwards, which goes on over the 19th century. By the 20th century, famously, people talk about in political terms, when everyone's got the vote, they say, well, you know, Paris is pretty conservative politically, but it's surrounded by a red belt because all the suburbs are basically workers' suburbs where they're all voting left. So that sort of modernization of the city does go hand in hand, as I think you were saying, really, with very straightforward and class attitudes towards the poor and attempt to make of Paris a city in which the ruling classes can feel happy and from which the poorer classes are marginalized.
So clearly from the end of the 18th century, from the revolution, which began 1789, then the rise of Napoleon afterwards, we had the Second Republic, the revolutions, not just in France, but across Europe in 1848 and that period, the Second Empire with Napoleon III. It was a pretty tumultuous century. And of course, as you say, Haussmann's changes to the architecture had an impact to the population at the center. But the 20th century was also pretty stressful for Paris.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, 20th century Paris. In some ways, I think the First World War really is a major, what would say, sort of turning point in Paris's history, because so much of the Paris that we know now was remodeled and very often rebuilt from the middle of the 19th century onwards. Or if it wasn't rebuilt, it was framed. You know, you think of something like the Bastille Monument or Notre Dame, actually. Notre Dame would be a good example of this, actually, because obviously Notre Dame's always been there. But until Baron Haussmann, in front of it, where now we have this enormous place, you know, and we all stand back and look at Notre Dame, etc., it's full of popular housing. It's absolutely full of popular housing. So, you know, those monuments from the past are framed in a very Haussmannian way, sort of big boulevards, vistas down the end of it. A lot of the 19th century, the sort of building, the apartment blocks, etc., etc. And that style is Haussmann and Napoleon III disappear in 1870, but under the Third Republic, they continue with that style. And it becomes Paris, modern Paris, essentially, right through to 1914. 1914, the money runs out. And indeed, France has a very tough war. I mean, Paris is famously nearly invaded. There are breakthroughs on the Western Front, in which, particularly at Verdun, in which looks like the Germans are going to move very swiftly towards Paris. Only a set of Parisian taxis sent out to the front carrying extra recruits saves the day in Parisian legend. But then after the war, very poor. Very, very little public building in Paris between the wars. And then, of course, in 1939, 1940, one of the darkest moments in Parisian history with the overthrow of the Third Republic and the installation of the Vichy regime and essentially Nazi occupation of Paris. And that, obviously, that there's a lot of historical interest and still political interest in that moment, but it is a particularly bad moment. France comes out of that war, possibly even poorer even poorer than it was after the First World War. And it takes a little time for Paris really to get its mojo back, so to speak, in the 50s and 60s. Intellectually, it's going strong. You know, you've got the existentialist movement on the bank there with Jean-Paul Sartre and the others in the late 40s and early 50s. But actually, a sort of resumption of growth, a sort of rethinking of the city, only gets going in the 1950s.
So you've talked about the various eras of Paris's development, from the Romans, the medieval period, the great developments of the 17th century and the Belle Epoque of the end of the 19th century. I'm going to ask you now to pick five sites from Paris that give readers an insight into a particular moment or theme in Paris's past.
Yeah, I thought a bit about this, and I've come up with five places which are very different and are scattered chronologically across Paris's history, but are also sort of places to reflect in and about. And the first of them is, I mentioned earlier, the Paris Arena, because the Roman Arena, it is actually quite a big arena. It's like a sort of big circular sort of thing, but it was only discovered when they were trying to build a bus depot in the 1880s. And at that moment, they thought a bus depot was far more important than a Roman arena, and they carried on with the bus depot. But when they were extending that in the late 80s and early 90s, they decided they would actually take the monument seriously. And they uncovered this very large building, but very little of it remains apart from the sort of design of the place. A lot of the rather low seats around it were actually put there. It's a sort of Disneyfied version, if you like. But it is completely tucked away. You know, we're so used to our Parisian monuments after Haussmann being sort of set in the vista, you know, you see from afar down a straight boulevard, that this sort of out of the way place. In fact, one of the obvious way to get to it is off the Rue Monge. And you actually go through a little passageway, a covered passageway between shops to get to it. You know, then you found it. And it's this haven of peace within Paris, where you just sit and the neighborhood kids come and kick a football around or throw a frisbee or whatever. It's a delightful place just to sit and reflect and put your feet up after a day's walking. The second place, I know people are going to go to the Louvre, and why not? And you should. But I think one place which I think might be interesting to just look at, and that again was only discovered much more recently, in fact, in the 80s and 90s, when they were rebuilding the underground of the Louvre and putting the glass pyramid there, etc., etc., they thought they'd make a big mall, a shopping mall underneath it. It's called the Carousel du Louvre. And when they did that, what they discovered was the foundations of the walls which the King Charles V at the end of the 14th century put there during the Hundred Years' War, basically to show Parisians this is a bastion and to keep the English out. And what is striking about it is they're sort of massive things. You know, we don't think of Paris like that, but that it's so central to what we think of Paris now. You know, we think of the Louvre as like it's nearly the center, and yet it's a couple of hundred yards away from the center. But that is the sort of reminds us of the military vocation, the military aspect of this city, the need to defend it right through the centuries. I have to have the revolution in, don't I, as a French revolutionary historian myself. But the place I'm going to suggest, I bet you a lot of people don't even know about, it is the cemetery that is out at the monastery of Picpus, P-I-C-P-U-S. It was a monastery under the Ancien Régime, still is a monastery. But in the grounds there, you will find the cemetery that was created in 1794 for victims of the guillotine, just as the guillotine was really warming up in the summer of 1794. And there's a sort of, what they basically did, they did, it wasn't a cemetery, it's more like a great big pit where they chucked the bodies in, chucked the heads in after, obviously, they'd been guillotined, put limestone over it and filled it up. But when that stopped, the guillotining stopped in that sort of way in 1794. And in the 19th century, they turned it into, and 19th and early 20th century, actually, they turned it into a cemetery. And anyone who was executed, and some of the elite families of the French aristocracy were buried there. And the families were allowed to put a funeral, you know, like a stone, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. One of the interesting and it's rather folkloric things about it, but which actually gives an incredible intensity to the site, is that the families of those people who were executed in that place and buried in that place in 1794 are allowed to inter their family members to this day. And just going through it, it's a very extraordinary snapshot not just of the revolution, but of French political life, because you see, okay, the Duke of this, he was executed in June 1794. His son, or great-grandson probably, shot down fighting for the French Flying Corps in the First World War. Son, grandson, deported, died in Dachau or whatever. So you get this very extraordinary sort of insight into an elite history, a political history of the elite, at the same time that you're in this sort of place of intense violence. Again, like the Arène, only more so, it is so quiet. So few people know it. I hope not everyone's going to go there now, but it is so quiet. It's so restful and it's so thought-provoking that it's a wonderful place to visit. I did mention earlier that my fourth place would be the Rue Saint-Honoré, because I think this is really, as I say, it's the shopping center. It's the birth of this consumerist world in the Rue Saint-Honoré. All the big dressmakers and fashion icons are down there. But if you go down it, because it's a very ancient street as well, you'll come across a monument, for example, to where Joan of Arc was wounded by an arrow, I think, crossbow arrow, when she was besieging the city in 1428. And then if you journey a bit down the road, just north of the Place de la Concorde, you'll find a plaque saying that Robespierre lived here between 1792 and 4. So you get a very interesting and reflective slice of Parisian life and over the centuries, I think. And then my final one would be, this is just a personal favorite, and again, it's fun place to go to, but the Place Saint-Sulpice. My book on the biography of Paris, I do a little thing on this, because it's really, a French writer called Georges Perec wrote a little pamphlet, really, called which was basically based on him sitting in a cafe on the Place Saint-Sulpice, which you can still visit, and just looking at and describing what he said. So, you know, people go by, a bus passes, a man carrying a plastic bag goes by, pigeons take off, some clouds come, there's a bit of rain, you know. So it's a sort of Paris without Paris, without the historic, without the busyness, the bustle of Paris, but letting the bustle just be the spectacle. I think Paris is one of those cities which has always interested people in that it's sort of very planned, but on the other hand, when you actually are there, you feel you're making your own city. You walk around it following your own itineraries, putting the city together in a way that's of value and will remain important to you after the event. And so I think sitting in the Café de la Mairie there, imagining yourself as Georges Perec, watching Paris go by, will be a very good, satisfying end for any journey and visit to Paris.
Wonderful. And you've spanned a good 2,000 years in your descriptions there, so plenty of places for people to explore the past. Finally, Colin, perhaps you could share one piece of advice for any listeners who are planning a visit to Paris.
Yes, I thought about this. I thought, well, obviously they have to buy my book, but I shouldn't say that. That would be too egocentric. I did think the other thing, I thought, well, you know, they're going to eat and they're going to drink. Maybe they should fast or maybe have a dry couple of weeks and then really enjoy it most. But finally, I ended up with thinking, and this is the advice I always give to students I'm taking over there when I take students over there, sensible shoes. Paris is best enjoyed on foot, and you'll do a lot of walking, and it's an extremely walkable city. You'll see so much and so intensely in Paris in a way that you don't necessarily in most other wonderful cities, but you will really put the sole of the foot onto the pavement, I think, a lot. And I think sensible shoes are an absolute necessity for any visitor to Paris.
Absolutely. I think, hopefully listeners will be inspired now to walk from the left bank over to the Marais and up to Montmartre, and they're going to cover a lot of miles. That was Colin Jones. His latest book, The Fall of Robespierre, 24 Hours in Revolutionary Paris, published by Oxford University Press, is available now. Thanks for listening. This podcast was produced by Jack Bateman.